The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Football Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Ellis James, and just when you thought there couldn't possibly be any more football, along comes the FA Cup final. We'll be previewing Arsenal against Chelsea and also be looking forward to another final whose participants are now 50% more certain than they were. Brentford, good on them, will be playing either Fulham or Cardiff City for promotion to the Premier League. We'll be saying goodbye to Brentford's old Griffin Park ground, and we'll stop at each of its four pubs to eat 30 raw peppers, or maybe just 15 Jonathan Wilson style. All that plus more in today's Football Weekly Extra. First up, the greatest transfer coup since Eric Cantona crossed the Pennines in 1992. It's the Guardian's most exciting young talent since a 13-year-old Barney Roney sat at the typewriter to express himself. His prose hitting the spot with the sound that stanchion made when Erling Haaland scored against PSG in February is Jonathan Liu. Jonathan!
Hi.
I've loved your columns this season, but when are you going to Kung Fu kick a reader? I'd love to see that done.
Yeah, we're always being encouraged to get down into the comments and indulge in our wide and varied Guardian community. So maybe that's a chance to do that.
Do you ever get stuck in to the comments out of interest?
I used to when I was at the Telegraph because it was just so fun needling Telegraph readers. But Guardian readers, they're slightly better informed. I mean, not to kind of reinforce a stereotype, but you know that there is the genuine peril that you are going to get ripped to shreds by superior arguments and superior arguing skills. So I try and avoid it wherever possible.
I've come for a fair share of stick on Five Live, and I just reply to every single tweet with, thanks for giving it a go, thanks for listening, have a good weekend. And I find it's a tremendously, it's quite an emollient just being pleasant on social media. Okay, our next panellist was going to get a similarly flowery introduction, so I read his Twitter bio and saw that it said football writer for The Guardian and semi-dormant wine blogger, Simon Burnton. I had no idea.
I mean, no one does, because I'm basically a completely dormant wine blogger. But there was a time when I was once named one of the best five wine bloggers in the world by the Wall Street Journal, I'll have you know.
Were you?
Yeah. I mean, it was a desperate listicle. I mean, you know these things. It doesn't actually mean best. It means one I happened to find in my 10 minutes looking.
Please don't take my dreams away from me. Whenever I've been mentioned on a listicle, I've been absolutely delighted. This is a very Partridge question, but how many bottles of wine do you have in your house at any one time?
Oh, right. Maybe 100, 150.
Good grief. Fair play. And is red wine the best wine?
It depends on the circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, that's a classic dormant wine blogger's answer.
Yeah, often.
Okay. All right, well, last but not least, there is nothing dormant about this man's complete mastery of the English language. A writer so steeped in the human experience that he can effortlessly conjure the warp and weft of the 21st century Irish experience or the minute-by-minute of Liverpool versus Burnley, and a man whose wide-ranging sexual career served as inspiration for Sally Rooney's Normal People, it's Barry Glendening. Barry, how are you?
I'm very well, Ellis. Thank you for that introduction. I did notice, I think it was The Guardian, actually, that got in trouble for this week for saying that the actor whose name I've just completely forgotten from Normal People was British. So he has reclaimed his nationality on Twitter. But yeah, I think the big question this morning, Ellis, is how are you? I had prepared one of those sort of Norwegian style commentaries your benefit, but having spoken to you briefly before we started recording, it would feel like kicking a blind man's stick to say like Keith Allen, Rob Brydon, Harry Secom, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Kerry Richards, Henry Vivian, Hugh Edwards, Rodri Owen,
Bonnie Tyler,
Kerry Rees-Matthew, Michael Heseltine, Dowie Zephaniah Phillips. Can you hear me, Dowie Zephaniah Phillips? Your boys took one hell of a beating. Yeah.
Well, if you're unaware of what Barry is talking about, And if you're unaware of the of why I don't have my customary zip in my presenting style, the reason I feel bereft is because the greatest, well, certainly in my opinion, the greatest fairy tale to hit football since probably Chesterfield reaching the semi-final of the FA Cup in 1997, or possibly Blyth Spartans getting to the FA Cup fifth round in 1978. Swansea City's playoffs dreams are over. So we lost to Brentford last night, 3-1, 3-2 on aggregate. They really got out of the traps very, very quickly. I think objectively it was probably a very good game to watch, but I can't really be objective on these things. So Jonathan, you were there. What did you make of it?
Well, it was an amazing game. You had no idea how these teams had, I think, 101 games in the legs already this season. It was quick. It was elastic. The tackles were flying in. And yeah, I think Brentford were quite deserving winners in the end. I mean, they got two goals in the first 15 minutes. And they, you know, they played with real kind of speed and aggression and intelligence and quick interplay. And I think by the time Swansea kind of realised they were in the game, they were already sort of 2-0 down and kind of fighting an uphill battle. It was great. I mean, that's a bit of a cliche, but, you know, it's a great advert for the Championship. But it really was one of the most entertaining games I've seen all season.
They beat Swansea 3-1 at Griffin Park, and they beat us 3-0 at the Liberty. We beat them 1-0 at the Liberty on Sunday. I mean, their mini little implosion at the end of the season aside, they've played some cracking football this season. So how well do you think they can cope with the Premier League should they go up, should they do the business in the final and get promoted?
Yeah, well, in terms of quality, I don't think they would have disgraced themselves in this season's Premier League. Certainly some of the players they've got, I mean, up front, Mbeumo and Benrahma and Ollie Watkins, that's a front three that I think could stand up to any, certainly in the Premier League bottom half. I was really impressed with Mathias Jensen in midfield. Not just the kind of the range of passing but sort of the way he would kind of send a defender just slightly off balance before playing the pass. There's a real kind of sophistication there. So I think, yeah, that they could definitely succeed in the Premier League. But the big danger for them is that, kind of like Derby in last season's playoff semi-finals, that was their final, with all the kind of the emotional heft of Griffin Park and you know, the farewell to Griffin Park after 116 years, that they then need to lift themselves next Tuesday against probably Fulham at what will be a kind of deserted and very strange Wembley. And that's going to be the real test for them.
Simon, where do you think it went wrong for Swansea yesterday?
Well, I mean, mainly that they played a team that was better than them. The Jensen through ball for Brentford's first goal was so good. I mean, it was, and that was a real moment of like, oh God, these guys are actually, you know, they can rip us apart. I did love Swansea's goal though, but Pontus Jansson, who has been a hero for Brentford this year, that the decision to attempt to cut out a bouncing through ball with a pirouetting back heel volley, flick volley clearance. I mean, that is right up there with the most stupid moments of defending that I can remember seeing in recent times.
There's such a thing as being too confident, I think, in your own abilities.
Yeah, they need to not read too much of their own hype.
What I loved about that was, after he failed to clear with the pirouette back heel flick, he was very agitated and giving out to his teammates as if they were in some way to blame.
Yeah.
Often you say, like, why didn't you give me a shout? And like, what kind of would the shout have been? Like, don't try back heel a bouncing ball.
Yeah. And the defensive pirouetting back heel never really caught on, did it? It's not like it's an aspect of the game that all of the great practitioners of defensive football have mastered over the last 100 years. I'd never seen it tried before. I've now seen it tried, and it patently doesn't work. So yeah, having a go at your teammates for somehow not reading what was quite a strange decision was an interesting thing to do. I must admit, I've been, you know, I've watched a lot of the Championship this season, and they have at times been hugely impressive. And I think that should they play Fulham, you know, who are 2-0 up on aggregate after the first leg against Cardiff, that leg is to be played tonight. Should they play Fulham or possibly Cardiff? I think I would put money on Brentford, because when they click, I think they're a really, really impressive team. But Barry, you're very impressed with their manager, Thomas Frank. So talk to me about that, because I think we probably have differing opinions on this.
Right, okay. Well, that's interesting, because I don't know what your opinion is, but I was part of his Zoom pre-match press conference, and I went into it, I must confess, knowing very little about him. But it was the most stirring, Churchillian, rabble-rousing press conference I've ever seen from a football. Like, normally these things are indescribably dull, but I closed the lid of my laptop and feeling like I would have run through a brick wall for him. And he laid out the game plan. He said, and it was on the record, certainly in the article I wrote up after it, that we will roar out of the traps and we will take this game to Swansea. And that is exactly what he did. But I was hugely impressed with him. His team play a lovely brand of football. And I'm now curious to know why you hate him.
I just think he looks like someone who unwinds by having sex with his wife and doesn't have any other hobbies. So I'm quite suspicious. I am quite suspicious of him. And some of his post-match stuff after the first leg at Liberty, you know, we were far the better side. I just thought, I thought he looked quite rattled personally. I mean, when they lost against Barnsley the final day of the season and he realised that they'd messed up automatic promotion, he looked an absolutely broken man. I really was clinging to that narrative. I really was hoping that they'd be so upset at how their season had ended that they wouldn't be able to lift themselves for these two games. But I think...
Well, I mean, you know, I have never seen a manager sound more bullish and confident before a game than he did before yesterday's game. Now, it may well have been an act, and it left me, and his rhetoric, which I found so stirring, it left me wondering, how on earth did you lose to Barnsley and Stoke? If, you know, because they're pretty bad teams, and Brentford are clearly a very good team. I think, while I feel your pain, Ellis, I think the better team has gone through to the final between Brentford and Swansea. I don't think you were hard done by. Old roasting last night.
There was a moment right at the end of the match yesterday where things briefly kicked off a bit on the touchline.
Yes, between Conor Roberts and Franks.
The manager should be staying out of the game. It looked like he'd tried to slow the game, keep the ball away from them for steal a few seconds, which, given the state of the game and the superiority of his team, seemed weird. And I'm not sure what his motivations were there, but I didn't really like that moment.
Because interestingly, they have a very small playing budget and they have two co-directors of football. So they've done very well with player sales. They've made a lot of money. So they're one of those clubs who, should they go up, you think they're probably quite well positioned to do well in the Premier League. Obviously, you know that there's the plan that there's the final to come yet, and they need to beat either Fulham or Cardiff. But they also haven't played in the First Division or the top flight since 1947. So it's a 73-year wait. So it'll be a cracking story if they do get promoted.
Every one of those words is visibly sticking in your throat.
But those ones, you were all right. I mean, obviously they had this, you know, the kind of miraculous way in which they got through to the playoffs in the first place. Kind of, they seemed to be riding a little bit on the momentum and that. And, you know, I really rate them. They, you know, Steve Cooper's a very good manager, and you know, they have kind of the decent skeleton of a side, which is in the summer just going to go back to its Premier League parent clubs. But you know, still
the skeleton of a good side is going to be dismantled because so many of our players are either at the end of their contracts or they're loanees who are going to return to their clubs. And there was an enormous cost-cutting exercise at Swansea, so we sold £40 million worth of footballer last summer. We spent £500,000 we basically have to rebuild, I think. And as successful a season as this was in the end, and I really, really didn't see us getting to the playoffs, I would have been quite happy with mid-table when you look at how young the squad is and how young a manager is. It's his first full-time managerial job in football. In a footballing sense, it felt like a free swing because I thought the players had overachieved. But financially, in the post-COVID-19 pandemic, you know, scenario, financially, it's very difficult to be in the Championship now. So I think we probably really needed that, and we've still got a couple of Premier League legacy contracts at the clubs. You know, people who are on big wages, so they're going to go, I would imagine, in the summer. So we're just going to have to start again. So hopefully, Steve Cooper will be able to work some sort of magic in the loan market, like he did in January when he got players like Conor Gallagher and Rian Brewster, who was a revelation. I mean, I thought he was an absolutely fantastic acquisition, and he's played so well since January. I get a lot of Liverpool fans asking me if he's good enough to play for Liverpool. I mean, he's not better than any of their front three, but he's certainly good enough to play in the Premier League, I would say. But Jonathan, you know, it was a farewell to Griffin Park. Do you have any fond memories of Griffin Park?
I mean, not really, but I mean, interestingly, I mean, it's my local ground. It's my local club. I sort of grew up in West London, grew up in Ealing, Greenford, actually. And they're the sort of the local club I spurned to go and support Spurs like a chump just at the start of the 1990s. It's an incredibly small ground. And it's, you know, when you think about these kind of giant megadromes that are getting built these days, it is very clearly built for an era where people were like, the average height of a male was about 5'4". There's not enough leg room, but equally, that's what made it such a kind of a bouncing, vibrant, loud, oppressive ground to visit. I mean, the first time I went was for the Leicester FA Cup tie earlier this season, and I was kind of astonished in the way that the terraced houses on Bremer Road, if you're in the garden of one of those houses, you're basically about 20 yards away from the pitch. You know, it's incredibly claustrophobic. And the sadness, I guess, is that those sorts of grounds not only, you know, increasingly don't exist, but pretty soon aren't really going to exist again.
Yeah, I loved it. I went there a few times with Swansea over the years, and I loved the fact that you could stand in the away end, because as an experience, that doesn't happen very often in the top two divisions anymore. It's redolent of a bygone era, and as a purist and a football romantic, I like those old grounds more than the new modern ones. But Simon, I suppose you've got the best of both worlds of Vicarage Road, haven't you, really? Because it's been done up, and it has changed, I imagine, since you started going. But it still feels like an old football ground, I think, Vicarage Road.
Yeah, I mean, it has changed a lot over the years, from obviously open stands, and we had a really rickety old wooden main stand for a long time, until just a few years ago, which was just gloriously flammable. I don't know. I've never felt that Vicarage Road is a noisy hotbed of wild support, but it is very much in its community and walkable from the Watford Town Centre, and that is where football clubs should be based.
Yes. Okay, well, let's look ahead to this evening's Fulham versus Cardiff second leg. Fulham firm favourites with a 2-0 lead from the first leg. A two-goal deficit has never been overturned in the Championship playoffs before. Are there any signs from the first game that Cardiff can do it, Barry?
The short answer, in my opinion, is no. I think Fulham were the better team. If Cardiff go 3-0 down on aggregate, that's it, game over, you'd have to say. If they can score first, I'd give them a chance. Any team managed by Neil Harris is going to go down throwing haymakers, sometimes literally. But I can't see beyond a Fulham win. Fulham, their weakness seems to be that their build-up play is very pretty and sometimes a bit ponderous, but they lack a cutting edge. And Cardiff, I suspect, and you would know better than me, Ellis, are already punching above their weight just by being in this these playoffs. And it seems to me, on the limited evidence of what I've seen from watching Championship football this season, that Brentford and Fulham are clearly the better of the two teams.
I mean, the way the tie stands at the moment, I think really, again, like Barry, I can only really see what one outcome from it. I thought Cardiff's best chance would have been essentially on the counter, because I mean, Fulham, if there is a weakness that Fulham have shown this season, it's occasionally I guess overcommitting and then leaving themselves a little bit vulnerable. But you know, going into the second leg 2-0 up, they really don't need to. They have the tie pretty much in the palm of their hands. So in terms of how Cardiff are going to pull it off, I can't really see many routes for them to do that.
Okay, well, the playoff final is at Wembley on Tuesday, the 4th of August. That's it for part one. We'll be back with our FA Cup final preview in part two. Okay, welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly. It's the FA Cup final, the showpiece event of the English football season on Saturday. Arsenal versus Chelsea. Barry, where's the game going to be won and lost?
Wembley, Ellis. A very empty Wembley. I am dreading this game. I will watch it because I'm obliged to, but I think it is awfully sad that the FA Cup final is being played behind closed doors. I would rather not have an FA Cup final than have an FA Cup final behind closed doors. It was always my favourite football occasion as a kid, watching the coverage from 10 o'clock in the morning till, you know, an hour after the game ended, and they had people on the team coaches. You know, there was normally an injured player or someone who was suspended would be the banter man on the bus. And he'd be going around interviewing the various players. They'd have packages done of the build-up, each team's build-up to the game. The fans and the atmosphere, the carnival atmosphere on Wembley Way is an integral part of the occasion. And then obviously the atmosphere at the game, 80,000 or whatever it was, packed in, the different colours festooning the stadium. And now we're going to get this anodyne, sanitised, diabolical effort at an FA Cup final on Saturday, and it really, really saddens me. I'd see it as little more than an exercise in box ticking from a, you know, financial record books and football records book exercise. Obviously, the players will want to win. It may very well be an excellent game, but if I had the choice, I just wouldn't bother with it.
In principle, I would agree, but you know, we've started, so we'll finish.
In Spain, Athletic Bilbao and Real Sociedad are in the cup final, and they have agreed, with the permission of the Spanish FA, not to play it until fans are allowed in the stadium. It's an all-Basque affair, obviously. That's never happened before. Now, I'm not saying that's what should have happened here, but I think the FA should have made some sort of effort. They will put on bells and whistles, and there'll be pyrotechnics and all sorts to try and distract from the fact that these players are doing their thing in front of 90,000 empty seats. But maybe if they played it in a non-league ground or something, I don't know. But I just find this so, so sad that an FA Cup final is being played behind closed doors.
Well, in years gone by, an Arsenal-Chelsea final would be a huge event. You know, a London derby in a final. I watched the Pathé newsreel coverage of Everton versus Sheffield Wednesday from the 1966 FA Cup final on YouTube earlier on. And it was, I mean, I think if you're under the age of 35, it's probably difficult to imagine just how significant a day in the footballing calendar the FA Cup was. I used to absolutely love it. I'm exactly like you, Barry. But over the last 10 years, since the 2010 final, it's been so dominated by the two Manchester clubs, Arsenal and Chelsea. An Arsenal-Chelsea final, as a neutral, it is hard to get quite excited about it. But, you know, Jonathan, it's Arsenal's final chance to get into Europe. Do you think Chelsea have got too much for Arsenal, bearing in mind that they finished 10 points ahead of them in the Premier League?
No, I think Arsenal have got a pretty decent chance. I echo what a lot of what's been said so far, it is going to be a pretty, it's going to be a really decent game, I think, that sadly is just going to kind of happen and then pass into the ether. And I think that's the shame of a FA Cup final these days. It used to be something that the season kind of tapered to, it built up to, and everybody watched it because after an FA Cup final, that was it for 3 months. There was no football. Whereas now, obviously, it just kind of leads into you know, Europe, and it leads into other things, and then obviously the new season about 5 or 6 weeks. That said, I think it is going to be a really good game. The two league meetings between Arsenal and Chelsea this season have both been kind of agreeably bonkers. There was the Chelsea comeback at the Emirates in about December, I think, when they kind of scored two late goals to snatch that game, and then there was the 2-2 at Stamford Bridge. That kind of the David Luiz game. I don't know if you remember where he got himself sent off early, and then Martinelli scored that incredible length of the field solo goal. I think the fact that these two teams are so imperfectly formed, and then you kind of throw in the weirdness of the occasion and the stakes involved, I think you've got all the ingredients for what could be like a really strange and wonderful and frenetic end-to-end sort of game. And if it's one in the midfield, then Arsenal win it. If it's one on the counter, I think Chelsea will win it.
Okay, which players are you going to be looking out for in particular on Saturday, Simon?
I will be looking out for, well, I guess Arsenal's defence is where it's going to be won and lost, I think. Against Manchester City, they held out really well, but they've looked a bit shonky when I've seen them recently. And certainly the two matches since they qualified for the FA Cup final and their particular circumstances, end of the season affairs. But I thought their defence was absolutely abysmal, both against Watford and Aston Villa. Liverpool basically thrashed them while still losing. It's just whether Arsenal's backline plays or folds.
Well, I've got an interesting question in from Matt Parsfield on Twitter. Frank Lampard won the FA Cup as a player under the management of Roberto Di Matteo, who'd previously won it as a player. If Lampard continues the pattern and gets a manager's winner's medal this year, who of his current squad is most likely to win the cup as a manager in the future? That's to the three of you.
Well, I suppose the easy answer is Azpilicueta, right? Because he's sort of seen as the wise head in the dressing room. I'd like to see an Olivier Giroud managed team. I think they'd be incredibly ostentatious and physical, but also charming.
And telling his strikers that scoring goals doesn't actually matter that much.
Yeah, of course, a Kepa managed team would be the most entertaining of all. It's sort of 5 minutes to go. Where's the manager? Oh, I don't know. He's gone and locked himself in the toilet again.
Okay, well, Chelsea are hoping Leicester will be forced to lower their asking price for Ben Chilwell by the left back requesting a transfer, and we'll be back with our dark horse player picks for next season after this. Welcome back. Before we look at potential dark horses to back next season, let's look at what the Premier League got right and wrong since lockdown. So your thoughts, Barry, what did the Premier League get right after the restart?
Well, I suppose the very fact that they got games played, there hasn't been any health issues on the back of the games being played, certainly that we're aware of anyway. I haven't enjoyed much of the football since restart. I must confess, I don't like watching games behind closed doors. I don't like being forced, as I am in some instances, to listen to fake crowd noise that isn't in sync with the actual game being played. I understand it's a difficult thing to do. But yeah, just getting the Premier League finished, I suppose, fulfilling their contractual obligations. But there have been some good games. But I wrote a column today talking about how since Project Restart, we've discovered the importance of fans in the game. I mean, we always knew they were important, but now we know exactly how important they are, and that fans have never been more powerful. And while it won't happen, wouldn't it be interesting to see how the Premier League and the TV companies and the FA would react if, when fans are allowed back into stadiums, they chose not to go until certain conditions were met, you know, like cheaper tickets and no more faffing around with the TV schedule at short notice, and clubs stopped rinsing them with regard to merchandise, that just little things like that. Obviously, it won't happen, but it would be interesting to see how these people would react if it did, because fans, whether they know it or not, currently have the football authorities and the TV companies over a barrel, because we now know exactly how much they bring to the party, and it's a lot.
I mean, in terms of what they didn't get right, I think the slow drip of matches, the spacing out of these kind of 92 fixtures to the point where there was kind of like a game pretty much every day, I think that really helped to almost stupefy the whole thing as an event. Barry's talking about fans in the stadiums, and I think he's right about that. I mean, the televised product is absolutely, you know, nothing like what we're used to or what makes the Premier League such a popular league around the world. Equally, though, I think there came a point, I mean, it's certainly in the last two or three weeks, where you think it's a Thursday night, oh my God, there's another game. Was it Sheffield United against West Ham? And I think never has this league felt more like baked beans being stacked in a supermarket. Just trying to dress up, you know, spaced out. Oh, we put this on Pick TV, you know, you can watch it free to air. And I don't know. I just felt that all that was kind of dispiriting. That you didn't look forward to a Premier League weekend anymore, because it was almost kind of impossible to discern where a match week started and where it ended. It just felt like this slow drip of quite bad Premier League football, and I kind of wonder what that's going to do long term to the product.
In terms of fans realizing how much power they have, I think fans in other countries are much better at wielding this. So I remember going to watch Swansea play Valencia in the Europa League in 2013. We beat them 3-0 at the Mestalla, and as a protest against how the club was run, the fans left at half-time. They didn't come back for about 25 minutes. And then when they eventually did come back, they stood with their backs turned to the pitch, away from the pitch rather. And that kind of fan protest, you don't really see it very often in English football. I mean, there have been occasions, but not to the same degree that you would see in France or Italy or Spain. But in terms of the restart itself, it's very rare. Well, players never get that kind of break. So what do you think that did to footballers, Simon, you know, having 3 months really without playing football at all?
So immediately after the restart, a lot of the football was really poor. And I think that if they were going to play out the rest of the season, so the impact of spreading the game, so there's games all like every day, was that every game was analysed often more than it deserved to be. Right? It got more attention than it merited. If you have a regular game day, if you have 6 games on a Saturday and 4 games on a Sunday, the bad games get lost in the cracks and we celebrate the good ones and forget about the bad ones. And we weren't allowed to do that because of the way that they were spaced out. I think that was an issue. I mean, generally, I think the players clearly behaved very well. There were very few positive tests. The issue is that the last third of a season is often not the best. There might be issues at the top and bottom, but there are going to be a lot of dead matches. And if we were intent on football coming back and playing 92 matches, and we wanted those matches to be as good as possible, it would have been better to have a bespoke competition for that period in which every match was meaningful in some way.
I just think it's very interesting because I've talked to so many footballers and I've asked them, you know, when have you been fully fit? And that fully fit is a slight misnomer, really, because everyone always answers me, the first game I played when I was 17, and after that, even if I was technically fully fit, I was sore or I was carrying a knock or I didn't feel great after training. So it must have been a revelation, really, for footballers to not be carrying injuries and to also not be sore from how difficult it is to play a Premier League match on a Saturday. I mean, and then to have to play another one a few days later. So I thought that was quite interesting. And I don't know if it's prolonged careers, or if it's allowed players to get to recover from injury more successfully than they otherwise would have done. But we're talking now about things like five subs. You know, there's a lot of debate whether this favours the big clubs or not. You know, what are your thoughts on that, Barry?
Well, my immediate reaction was that obviously, yes, it would favour the big clubs, because if you look, if you're Sheffield United playing Manchester City and you look at the respective benches, you've got, you know, seven players on the City bench who would probably automatically get into the Sheffield United team, and that is not in any way, before Sheffield United fans get cross with me, to disparage Sheffield United, who are an excellent side. But Sean Ingle flagged up an article yesterday that some sort of egg-headed scientist had written, pointing out that actually it probably wouldn't benefit the richer teams. But I don't particularly see how that's possible, but
yeah, I thought that was a really interesting article. I think it was written by like the Athletic Bilbao head of conditioning, something like that, some coach at Athletic. And his idea, I think, was basically that if you've got a really big team with a strong first 11 and not so good second 11, then they aren't going to proportionally benefit from having five subs. Whereas if you've got a team with where all of the players are pretty much of the same standard, then you are going to be able to make lots of subs without diluting the quality of your 11 on the pitch, which is kind of an interesting idea. I mean, I suppose what the unknown is, I mean, as every kind of five-a-side team knows, that the optimum time to hit an opposition team is after they've just made a couple of subs, and they don't know who's marking who, they don't know who's supposed to be where, and that's always the big unknown with substitutions, not the quality of the players that are coming on or the quality of the players that are coming off, but how it affects the dynamic, how it affects the system and the collective and the, you know, the players relative to each other. And so I think that the teams that are going to benefit most from having five subs are the ones that have the strongest system, I think, having the strongest idea of their collective function. And that doesn't necessarily mean the big clubs, although I guess in terms of Manchester City and Liverpool, there's generally a correlation between the teams that have the strongest kind of collective idea and success on the pitch. But I think it also benefits teams like Burnley, for example. You make five subs and the players that come on the pitch are more likely to know how they're going to fit into the system than if you're coming into, say, Jose Mourinho's Tottenham side, where the tactics could change from week to week. I mean, the irony, I guess, is that Burnley probably made the fewest subs of any team in the league. But I think it's slightly more complex than the big teams have deeper benches, then they're going to benefit most, because I think it's about more than individual player quality.
We're kind of assuming that substitutions continue to be made in the way they've previously been made, but having five substitutions means that you could premeditate a significant tactical change. So you can have three players on the bench that you are going to bring on in the 60th minute, everyone knows that you are, and that, like, let's say you have three pacey forwards and you can have a tactic for the first part of the game that is not based on scoring, but is just based on stretching your opponents and tiring them. And then at some point in the second half, you bring on enough players to change shape, impetus, and direction, rather than taking off individual players because they're a bit tired.
Okay, well, looking forward to next season. Have any of you got any dark horses, players that the general football fan might not have heard of or might not be aware of, who you think might burst onto the scene and take us all by surprise? Basically, players who are going to be cheap to buy for your fantasy league team, but are going to eventually pay dividends. Jonathan, I've got a feeling that you've got a couple of these in your back pocket.
Well, I've been very impressed with Brighton's business so far. The little known, obscure Adam Lallana, who has kind of been sort of forgotten about since he was such a key player for Liverpool and England, actually. He's turned up I think the only South Coast club, well, one of the few South Coast clubs he hasn't already played for. And the other guy that they signed from Ajax, yes, their defender, Joel Veltman. I mean, having seen quite a bit of him with Ajax in Europe, seems to fit that kind of easy on the eye, you know, quick vertical style that Graham Potter wants him to play. So, yeah, I quite like Brighton as a as a dark horse for next season.
Right, Simon, what about you?
So maybe we've seen quite a bit of Shea Adams this year, but I thought his form has really transformed towards the end of the season. And from being, he didn't score a goal until July, but next year I would hope they'll see more and better of him at Southampton. I think maybe it's Rian Brewster's time, we talked about him earlier, whether at Liverpool or otherwise, I expect he'll be in the Premier League next season, hopefully making an impact there.
And I will wish him well. I'll be there at Swansea train station, giving a kiss as he as the train goes off into the distance. Bit of any other business. And we're next for Watford.
Well, it's a big question. I think that the squad needs to be changed considerably. Obviously, we need to reduce headcount and wage bill. But some of the older players who are experienced and think they should be playing at a higher level should probably go away. And there are quite a lot of young players who belong to the club but haven't been playing for them this season, but have been doing pretty well on loan in other places, who could come back and make an impact, or they might not want to. There's a left-back who's been on loan in Spain, Pervis Estupinan, who's been having a great season. There's the other Luis Suarez. He scored 19 goals this season for Real Zaragoza. And maybe if Luis Suarez is playing for us, he might have an impact. But essentially, the team needs to be rejuvenated. There needs to be a coach who sticks around a bit, both for the players and for the fans. You know, fans need someone to like hang their hopes on. Watford, they haven't really had that because the owners very rarely speak in public and the managers, head coaches change so regularly. I think that there is a need for just someone to be the body and the face that people see the club as for a little while.
Chris Hughton, Simon, has been suggested, you know, what with his experience of getting teams promoted, would you be happy with him? His team style of play can be a bit cautious.
Yeah. So essentially, on the plus side, he seems an extremely decent man. And that is good. On the downside, I've not been wowed by any of his teams. They're not particularly entertaining. And so pros and cons. I think that I wouldn't instinctively embrace that appointment because I've seen a lot of his teams in the past. And they could appoint any number of people I've never heard of and who would arrive with no preconceptions. Maybe better. For people who have supported Watford for 20, 30 years, any period in the Premier League is a bit like a fairy tale. It's inherently temporary. We don't belong there. Sooner or later, we'll go back down. And the question is always how we land once we come to Earth. The last couple of times we've been relegated, we have then come very close to going out of business within the next 2 or 3 years, and that is always the danger. Hopefully, these owners have a longer-term vision and ability. So my son is distraught. He's 11. We've been in the Premier League for 5 years, and it's basically all he knows. But I am very sanguine. I frankly prefer the Championship in many ways. But how I feel about this period in our history, I will decide that at some point in the future when I know its long-term impact.
Okay, well, you wrote an article, Jonathan, about how Yaya Toure hasn't had quite the same level of send-off as David Silva at Man City. So why do you think that is then?
Well, I think, obviously there's lots of reasons. It is patently a reaction to some of the David Silva coverage over the last few days, last few weeks, I guess. It's been this kind of extended farewell tour ever since he announced he was leaving. And the point of it, I guess, was not to say that David Silva isn't deserving of any of this, that he's not a brilliant player, that he's not, you know, one of the most incredible players in City's history, because all of those things are true. His legacy is kind of unquestionable. But interestingly, all these discussions were cropping up, you know, greatest City player of all time, greatest Premier League midfielder of all time. Bernardo Silva, I think, called him one of the greatest midfielders of all time, which I think is a leap, but, you know, fair enough. And I was just thinking, where is where is Yaya Touré in all of this? And the answer, of course, is that, you know, he left, was it 2 years ago now, under a little bit of a cloud. His last two seasons at City were kind of a little bit of a damp squib. There was, of course, the well-publicised falling out between his agent, Dimitri Saluk, and Pep Guardiola over, amongst other things, the birthday cake and kind of the accusations of racism. And it just felt, even though, it ended, you know, he got his farewell in the end in 2018, a home game against Brighton, it felt a little bit cursory. It felt a little bit prosaic. It felt a little bit off. And I guess the point I was trying to make is that it's not just about how things end, but how things end influences how players are remembered. So these white hot years in between about 2012 and 2014, when Yaya was legitimately one of the best midfielders in the world, certainly the best midfielder in the Premier League, and that's kind of all been airbrushed slightly. I don't you know want to make too much out of it, because I don't think it's the sole reason at all. But I think there is kind of an element in which to which white players are potentially seen as more sophisticated than black players. This is a kind of a topic that's been touched on quite a lot in recent weeks. That if you go on the internet and look at compilation videos of Yaya Touré, it's beast, powerhouse, monster. You contrast that with some of the tributes to David Silva. People talk about his sophistication, his intelligence, but, oh, he played football the way it was meant to be played. That just struck me as quite a dissonant juxtaposition between what is in fact two incredibly talented, two great midfielders who each played their part in hauling City to where they are now, and yet are remembered quite differently, I think.
You know, there are studies that show that black players, their attributes are discussed in a different way to white players. And the commentators are more likely to describe them as powerful or a specimen. That's the word that gets bandied about. So I'm sure there's something in it. But
I think you see it also with players like Pogba. And when you have such a broad skill set, and it's kind of ridiculous, it would be ridiculous to argue that Yaya's strength, his physical strength and his pace, certainly early in his career, weren't like integral elements of his game. But I think it's harder with certain kinds of player to overlook that, to see anything beyond that. Whereas, you know, for example, Silva could be an incredible shithouse. Like, certainly early in his career, he was, you know, he could take out your ankles like anybody else. But somehow, you know, that kind of thing gets overlooked. And
I hope he gets to write his obituary in years to come.
Yeah.
He could be an incredible shitter.
Is there a case to be argued as well that Yaya always had plenty to say for himself? He was happy to go in front of the cameras. He was embroiled in various minor controversies, whereas David Silva just very quietly went about his business. I can't remember ever seeing him, I don't think, being interviewed before the weekend.
Yeah, he would do basically one interview a year to promote, was it the Mallorcan Tourist Board or something? Some tourist board. I mean, basically that was the only interview he did in a year. And yeah, but I guess that also kind of feeds into what we want from footballers in certain players. You know, only doing one interview a year, so not doing any press, being quiet, getting on with your job is seen as being kind of surly or reticent, whereas the player that gets in front of the camera and gets embroiled in controversy is seen as a bit of a character. It's kind of interesting. It's just sort of interesting how players get pigeonholed, because they do thousands and thousands of things on a pitch, and are the way we remember them is really only going to consist of a tiny, tiny percentage of all the things they've done. What we remember of a player can never be the totality, or even, you know, vaguely representative of what they've done.
I now have this image in my head of sort of a media centre with David Silva in one booth extolling the virtues of Tenerife, and Roy Keane in the next one, surrounded by Labrador puppies who were going to become guide dogs, because that's his annual interview.
Okay, well, that's all for today. So thanks to Jonathan, Simon and Barry. Max is back with you on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.